With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Today on the Woven Energy Podcast.
It's not the case that shamanism itself developed late in Japan. Shamanism was in Japan as soon as people were in Japan, because the first people who arrived in Japan were shamanists. Shamanism, people start to revert to shamanism when instability is introduced into society, and when society starts fragmenting. And that makes perfect sense, because shamanism is very, very good at running small groups of people. One of the other issues with Japan is probably one of the world's worst cases of the rewriting of history. Even worse than China. Went along the lines of good people do good things, bad people do bad things, but it takes religion to make good people do bad things. So they started changing the religion. And when you're very well educated and very broadly educated, and you view religion in an exoteric way, it's very, very easy to start pulling holes in it. You know, it can't possibly be true. You know, it's just nonsense. But the biggest place where this stuff survives today in Japan is in the various branches of the Shinshukyo, the new religions. But even there, you have to look at it with an educated eye. You have to investigate, as I've done. So they started clamping down on it. And ironically, this gave rise to a wave of shamans, some of them great shamans that arose in Japan at around this same time. If you look at what happened with these shamanistic groups in Japan, it took 20 years maximum for them to become ridiculously esoteric from a very, very shamanistic starting point.
Hey guys, welcome to the Woven Energy Podcast with me, Joseph Sikora, and Damon Smith, bringing you, as always, a complete resource on shamanism from the ground up. Now, the last few episodes have been focused on practical techniques from Stage 2, the Amska, and as always, these techniques are only useful and mean anything when you build them on Stage 1, Chelicity. You can't listen to these episodes enough, and that's Episodes 7, 8, and 9, and also our little side episode between Episodes 18 and 19. These cover Chelicity in quite a bit of depth, and I'm sure there will be more to come. But this week, Damon had the idea of doing an episode on an introduction to Japanese shamanism, as the next Amska technique he wants to teach comes from Japan. Now, it's a fundamental message of this podcast that besides the cultural aspects, the heart of shamanism is the same thing wherever you find it. And this is something which becomes very apparent as soon as you start actually practicing it for real, and not either think you're practicing it or approaching it academically. It's what separates shamanism from religion, and in many ways proves to us who practice it that man is not our teacher, the natural world is. However, this is not to say that there isn't anything to explore by looking at shamanism from different areas of the world, as it broadens our perspective and it widens our palate. So, Japanese shamanism, not something many people would be familiar with, myself included, so I'm very much the student in this episode, and I'm going to hand you all over to Damon. Damon, there is so much to explore here, but do you want to start with a general introduction to Japanese shamanism and why you want to bring it up?
Sure. So, well, I guess the simple reason we want to bring it up is we want to do a Japanese style Amska technique. So, but you know, it's an interesting subject. The development of Japanese shamanism kind of parallels the development of shamanism that we talked about in China, except it obviously it happened at a later date. The development of the forms of shamanism that exist in Japan today started at a later date than the forms of shamanism that exist in China today. Mm. It was really starting only about 300 BC that the transition from old hunter-gatherer style shamanism, which was the same everywhere, virtually the same everywhere, to the sort of embedded forms of shamanism that we see today got started in Japan, which is obviously much later than the similar thing happened in China. So what I'm saying is, it's not the case that shamanism itself developed late in Japan. Shamanism was in Japan as soon as people were in Japan, because the first people who arrived in Japan were shamanists. But it was that old school shamanism that's, you know, virtually identical, hunter-gatherer shamanism that's virtually identical with a few, shall we say, trivial, superficial variations the world over and throughout all time. But the ways in which shamanism survived in Japan, that's probably the best way to put it, started developing at a later time because the Japanese people stayed shamanistic longer. The rise of agriculture, serious agriculture in Japan happened during a period of time when, I guess you could say that agricultural wealth and agricultural technology got serious enough that they could propel certain individuals into positions of power and start the exoteric revolution, if you like. And obviously Japan had less agricultural land available than the north of China, for instance.
What kind of period are we talking here? Like 300 BC?
The period has a name. It's called the Yayoi period in Japan. And it extends from 300 BC through to, you would say, depending on how you count it, 250 AD through to 300 AD, that sort of time period. So
600 years.
600 years either side of zero BC, or zero AD, and this was a heavy transitional period. There are various arguments among archaeologists of whether the Yayoi people were actually the self same people as the earlier Jomon culture, which are much more shamanistic culture. That ran from sort of 14,000 BC through to 1,000 BC. Mm-hmm. Or whether the Yayoi was just a development of earlier cultures. My own guess on these things is that there's a combination of both things going on. You have people coming in from outside. I mean, very clearly, despite, you know, one of the other issues with Japan is probably one of the world's worst cases of the rewriting of history, even worse than China. And, you know, that's continued right into modern times. I mean, the very few things have been more influential on the rewriting of history. Whether that's rewriting it into a more correct or less correct form is irrelevant, really, than the Japanese loss in the Second World War. So we're talking about very modern times, history being rewritten for political purposes. You know, also the lead up to the Second World War, when, originally Japan was brought out of isolation by the Americans in 1853. A guy called Matthew Perry humiliated them militarily. Basically, Japan was still an old school feudal culture, you know, and they had swords and they had the odd flintlock musket, and they, you know, and he basically sailed modern warships into what is now Tokyo. It was called Edo in those days, Harbor, and just humiliated the military government, which about a decade and a bit later actually fell as a result of this and other things. So when you look at Japanese history, you have a lot of hard work to do to see what goes on, because even today, the influence of the loss in the Second World War is very, very strong on historians. And you don't really, you know, you have to fight to get a clear picture, any kind of a clear picture of what actually went on in Japan. But and part of the reason that this is particularly strong in the domain of shamanism and the origins of shamanism is, of course, what's known as state Shinto. Shinto was the religion that developed out of, the group of religions that developed out of traditional Japanese shamanism. And if you can think of Shinto before sort of probably the turn of the 19th century, that'd be around 1800, you can think of Shinto as a group of local semi-shamanistic religions that have been exotericized to an extent, but which still have very, very significant, strong shamanistic
You don't need components. To dig that far beneath the surface.
Yeah, well, certainly in 1800 you wouldn't have had to. But what happens subsequently is that Japan, because of the humiliation of the and the eventual fall of the, you know, Japan had a military government for a long time. Because of the fall of the military government and the restoration of the emperor to power in 1868, you gotta think that you talk about putting the emperor back on the throne. Japan hadn't had an emperor on the throne since 1185, so this is, you know, this is a very, 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 very big move to put the emperor back on the throne after all that time, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it had emperors, but they weren't in any kind of power. They were the Japan was run by a bunch of what we would call generalissimos. But anyway, so they put the emperor back on the throne, and then Japan immediately went the other way. It went from this insular country to this very, very Western-leaning culture. And they imported a lot of expertise from the West, actually from the UK in particular. They hired a lot of our military people, naval people, army people, and we helped them modernize their military, get a modern navy, a modern army, modern air force. And we also trained them in something else that we were doing at that time, which we don't do anymore, but we were doing at that time. You got to think, you know, the late 1800s, we trained them in empire building. If you like, you can think of Britain as their teacher, who they sort of looked up to and respected, and that their respected teacher was doing empire building. So Japan thought, maybe we should do empire building too. and the rest is history, right? You know, so... So, and it wasn't just Britain, you know, the other countries were doing empire building at the same time. So this was the start of all the trouble, really. And in order to galvanize, so, you know, when you build an empire, your forces have to do pretty unpleasant things. They have to go into the countries of other people and basically forcefully suppress those people and make them do your bidding in a very, very, you know, command and control kind of model. It's sort of like taking that general idea of the Wang at the top of society, having control of the agricultural surplus and then imposing their will down through layers of sub-operatives. You could take that on a global scale and then you get empire building like the British Empire, the Japanese Empire.
Empire by force rather than stealth.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically you have to get your people to do some pretty unpleasant stuff. And it's quite hard to persuade people because people tend to be naturally good. You know, they tend to be naturally quite nice people on the whole. And how do you get nice people to do bad things? Well, I forget who it was that said this. I think it might have been Richard Dawkins, or it might have been Richard Dawkins quoting somebody else, but it went along the lines of good people do good things, bad people do bad things, but it takes religion to make good people do bad things. So they started changing the religion, started engineering their religion to support the military and Western democratic governmental model. You could call it a democratic military complex, something of that nature. They had exactly the same kind of democracy that we have. It's a parliamentary democracy based on the British model. And, you know, the emperor is at the head of that. And, you know, the emperor was in some ways a figurehead, in some ways very powerful, which very, very closely paralleled the monarch of Britain at the same time. Obviously, that'd be Victoria. So what happened was they put this great, so they needed to unify. They needed to unify the country. And what Shinto was not a great, the original Shinto was not a great unifier. It was little local groups doing their semi-shamanistic things in different ways in different times in different places all over the country. That wasn't good enough. So they started to come up with, if you like, a Western religious style, I don't know what you would call it, really, a doctrine or dogma, set of dogmas. Because what they saw is that, you know, the people that were learning from, which us and other countries, successful countries, in the as successful as they saw it in the West, we had these things we call religions of a book. And they tend to galvanize us. So Christianity, Islam, Judaism all have a book or scrolls or something that they hold to be the truth of their religion, or to contain the truth or truths related to their religions. And this sort of forms a central focus. This doctrine or dogma forms a central focus.
Something to refer to, something solid that they can refer to.
Exactly. So, but Shinto didn't have anything like this. You know, Shinto is Shinto grew out. It's just the natural extension of shamanism developing within an increasingly exoteric society, but it didn't have any equivalent of that. So they went back to actually some early historical records. Two things. One was called the Kojiki, and the other one's called the Nihon Shoki. And these two books are really sort of, you know, those sort of King Arthur and his knights type of thing. That time period when mythology is crossing over into history, and they're sort of like mythical history books.
Yeah.
And they tried to make a religion out of this, and they called it State Shinto. And it had very, very little in common with Shinto, if you like.
State Shinto. All right. State Shinto, yeah. Sounds dodgy, doesn't it?
Sounds dodgy as hell, doesn't it? You know. And so they used this new religion to unify and galvanize the country. But at the same time, there was a lot of social upheaval going on inside Japan. And so ironically, because they tried to clamp down, actually, they for a period of time they had the opposite effect on some certain sections of society. There was sort of a knee jerk. So if you like, they come in and said our religion's not exoteric enough, so they started clamping down on it. And ironically, this gave rise to a wave of shamans, some of them great shamans that arose in Japan at around this same time, who sort of found
it forced them out. It forced them
gathered. Well, I don't know if it forced them to actually appear in the first place, but there was certainly an appetite for going countercurrent at that time, you know? Yeah. So we're talking about the late 1800s, early 1900s, yeah? By the time you get around to the sort of 1930s, then the government's State Shinto had got control of education. And so that these things were suppressed pretty brutally eventually. But for a time period, they kind of flourished. And it's often an overlooked time period. And you have some of the most famous shamans in Japanese history during this time period. Shimoyama Osuke, Nakayama Miki, Onishi Ajiro, Bunjiro Kawate. A bunch of these people flourished during this time period. And they were effectively, I guess they were what people might describe as great shamans. There were people who didn't just go into the shamanistic state every now and again, but kind of lived and breathed in it, didn't rarely left it, I think is probably the best way to put it. And each one of these people gathered a following. Shimoyama Osuke was associated with a mountain called Mount Antake in Japan. And the following of people that gathered around him were called Ontakekyo, after the mountain. And, you know, we've talked about Maiza before, haven't we? On the podcast, you know, that they are big on that kind of thing. It's very much, I don't know, did we discuss the decision, the distinction between Kami Oroshi and Kami Gakari on this podcast? I can't remember if we did that or not. But just briefly,
we might have done in the Miasma episode when you were talking about Maizar.
Yeah, they're two different ways of looking at experiencing the shamanistic state. And they're definitely post-analysis. They have nothing to do with when you're in the shamanistic state. But there can be a sense that the spirit of nature is being actively drawn down inside you through the technique. And that would be called Kami Oroshi. But there's also a sense where you become, I think we talked about like a tea bag in the ocean, where the spirit of nature just permeates you through its own energy and through its own devices. And that would be Kami Gakari. And these people, a lot of these people were very much of the latter. In terms of what they were famous for, the shamanism that they were famous for, they were very much of the latter variety. And they developed significant followings during this time period, which during the sort of 1930s, late 1920s, early 1930s to mid 1930s got heavily suppressed, but they weren't stamped out entirely. So then there was a further wave of the expansion of these things. Once the Japanese lost the Second World War, there was immediately a further wave of expansion. The state Shinto had obviously been, you know, overthrown. It had gone, thanks to MacArthur and others. But again, talking about
just
the
rewrite, to explore that a second, I've lost you there.
Oh, sorry. The American occupying forces or the Western occupying forces in Japan after the Second World War.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Okay.
They overthrew a lot of these institutions that the Japanese had been told were ancient, like the state Shinto. Really ancient. Less than 50 years old. That's really ancient. That is, you know. Depend on your way you look at it, you know.
Yeah.
But we had this amazing period of repetitive rewriting of history. We had the rewriting of history with the fall, following the fall of the military governments in Japan. It might be worth saying a word or two about that in a moment. We had the rewriting of history in order to support the rise of the Western leaning militaristic empire building government in Japan. Then we had the Second World War, and we had the rewriting of history in order to get rid of these things that the Japanese government had put in order to brainwash the people into supporting the war effort. And then we had the rewriting of history again in order for the Japanese to justify to themselves their meaning in a new world where they'd lost this war and a lot of the values that they valued, like the undefeatability of the Japanese people, you know, going back to the Mongol invasions and the kamikaze, you know, the kamikaze being the divine wind that was supposed to come along during the Mongol invasions. Actually, its significance was much lower than is usually billed. So that the modern Japanese have to come to terms with this, and so that a rewriting of history again, just in order to make that comfortable. And I predict there is a further rewriting of history that's going to go on in future when a Japanese generation, you know, become the historians of the future who have no particular connection to the events of World War II within themselves. And then there will be a rewriting again at that point.
You think a rewriting to try and write it back to it more, a more accurate depiction of what the history
was? Is that ever possible? That's a question, you know, is that ever possible? What my view on this, you know, I've done a bit of history in my time. My view on this is that rather than trying to figure out what really went on, you want a broad picture. You want to get everybody's view, all the different interpretations of what went on. And then through that, you know, kind of shamanistically, if you like, you can get some sort of feeling for what went on, some kind of flavor of what went on. Being opinionated about stuff is not very helpful. You know, in general, sometimes heuristics, rules of thumb can be useful in certain contexts, especially when there's no time to think. But really a good broad view and Japanese history is very, very complicated. But you do need to understand the motivations behind the rewritings. Another motivation in modern Japanese society is that there's a rebellion against, they call them the Shinshukyo, the new religions, new religions that grew up in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and then just, again, they had another burst after the end of World War II. These new religions, they were all founded, most of them, vast majority of them were founded by shamans, or founded by somebody who was close to a shaman, more like, for instance, the Nakayama Miki, the shamaness, didn't actually found Tenri no Kosha. Nakayama Miki's son, Shuji, founded Tenri no Kosha. Nakayama Miki herself, the shamaness herself, actually frowned on that activity and wasn't very impressed, frankly. But
why was that?
There's a number of reasons. You know, shamans tend not to be into these hierarchical kind of things. And when you create a group, a religious group, you need somebody at the top of that. Well, people seem to think you do. And then under that, there'll be, I don't know, if you want to think about it, you've got your cardinals and your deacons and your bishops and your archbishop, you know, these different kind of ranks.
Yeah.
And it has nothing whatsoever to do with what Miki and others were trying to teach, which was shamanism. But people have this stuff so deeply ingrained within them that they feel a need to do that kind of thing. And her very own son, Shuji, felt the need to do this, and she thought it was a bit daft. Another reason that so obviously when these groups started to become bigger, the government started cracking down on them pretty heavily. There was a lot of persecution, all of them, pretty much all of them. And one of the motivations for Shuji to found that Tenryu no Kusha was to get protection from, at that time, the most powerful religious body in Japan, which was known as Yoshida Shinto. We can maybe go into why Yoshida Shinto is very, very important. Because if you like, Yoshida Shinto was an attempt to get back to the more shamanistic origins of Shinto. Because at a much earlier date, certainly during the late, mid to late imperial period, this is before the military governments arose, Buddhism came into Japan and started exotericizing Shinto. There was a wave of exotericism. There was a wave of exotericism at that point. So it was during the Narahira Heian periods, and a bit earlier. So effectively, Yoshida Shinto was created by a guy called Yoshida Kanetomo. Well, it wasn't created by him. Okay, let's wind all the way back. We have to go back a long way. So these early shamans in Japan, just like anywhere else, as soon as the power structures started to appear in Japan, so this would be like the Yayoi period, or maybe a little bit earlier into the Jomon period.
Which is where?
Let's
just put a date on this.
300 BCE-ish, yeah?
Okay.
So these power structures...
Can I just ask, until that 300 BC, there would be what you would call a bit more leaning towards hunter-gatherer shamanism?
Yeah, much closer anyway, much closer. So from that point onwards, you got the progressive development of exotericism. And the exotericism, it immediately seeks to suppress shamanism because, you know, shamans their allegiance is to nature, it's not to individual human beings. And their allegiance is also to the good of the group as a whole. That was always their role, not to the good of particular individuals within the group. So they had to go underground. And one of the ways in which they went underground was to take on jobs that were good covers for their shamanistic activities. So that is, you take on a work role within society that when you practice shamanism, it doesn't make your work role doesn't make that look that unusual. And one group of shamans became what were known as omyosha. Omyosha are like court divinators. They're people who, in the Western sense, you know, we talked about the dragon bones in China, didn't we?
Yeah.
And the oracle bones and that type of stuff. So the Omyosha were doing this type of thing. They were divinators to the imperial court, and they were, you know, telling the emperor things like, oh, we'll probably have a good harvest next year, all that kind of stuff. So you know, we've talked about this. Some of them could be doing that genuinely shamanistically, and they might have been actually right. And others may have been doing it just as a kind of, you know, way of making a living, and didn't care whether they were right or wrong. But basically, they became a group of omyosha who were called divinators to the imperial family, and they sort of consolidated into a what you would call a secret family, known as the Urabe. The word can have many different interpretations, but here's one that was taught to me. If you flip a coin, and you're allowed to land on the table, say, the side that's uppermost, that's known as omote, that's the obvious or visible side. But the side that's underneath, if it's heads upwards, then the tail side of the coin, that would be Ura, the hidden side, the side you can't see. And Be can mean clan or family. So if you think of that, Ura, the hidden family, Urabe, the hidden family, is what they were originally called. And these people became very, very useful to the emperors and later to the shoguns when the military governments, they were quite flexible. They were still very, very shamanistic people. And if either an emperor or a shogun, you wanted something done with a certain level of subterfuge or something done in a fairly sophisticated way, rather than, for instance, using main battlefield troops, you might want something done in a more
subtle way.
They would often turn to these people to the Urabe. Now, the emperors were quite pleased with these guys, and they obviously did a good job because they lasted forever, the Arabi family. I mean, in some circumstances, they're kind of still going in Japan today. Yeah, so, you know, they lasted forever, but they're nowhere near as powerful as they once were. And so what happened was that the divinators, they became so powerful that they had to do a lot of their stuff in the open. And so one of the emperors gave them this name, Yoshida, as a kind of family name, under which, a banner under which they could pursue their stuff more openly, things more political. Because they were doing stuff on such a big scale that it couldn't all be secret and behind doors, because we're talking about eventually doing stuff on a national scale in Japan. At one point, the Yoshida family controlled most of the shrines in Japan, and there are thousands and thousands of shrines in Japan, for instance. You can't sort of cover that kind of thing up, so they used this word Yoshida rather than Arabi. And they just grew increasingly powerful. And the transition in 1185 from imperial rule to military rule, it put a little stop to that for a while. So the imperial rule came to an end, as I said, 1185. And that was the start of the first military government. Probably everybody's heard of a shogun. Probably because of the famous book by James Clavell, you know, called Shogun, yeah. And I think there's also a car called a shogun, isn't there? Off-roader or something, yeah. So shogun was like a generalissimo, and the very first one was a guy called Minamoto Yoritomo, who leveraged a bunch of guys who had been called the Konde, the stalwart youths. They'd been guys who'd grown up in the countryside but had become powerful militarily. And he used that to propel himself into a position of power within Japan, and effectively usurped the position of the head of state. And basically what he did is he turned the emperor from a de facto ruler into a puppet ruler, and effectively became the real ruler himself. Mm. That was done under military force, and that first Kamakura period, which ran from about 1185 through to 1333, that I think it's 1333, that was a military might type of thing. And did they ever need it? Because that was time the Mongols showed up. You know, we said the Japanese are the only people who ever beat a main battle force, Mongol army in the field. And they did so twice, really, which is quite impressive, when everybody else was losing to them left, right, and center, you know? So unfortunately for the Mongols, that was the time period during which they arrived. And what they ran into was a bunch of professional soldiers, you know, which they hadn't really encountered anywhere else, except maybe the Mamluks from Egypt. But in general, they hadn't really, most of the soldiers in those days weren't full-time professionals. A guy called Hojo Tokimune was very instrumental in that, one of the world's least known and probably greatest generals. During that period, Japan was ruled with, if you like, a bit of an iron fist. The Yoshida stroke Urabe were still there. They were still reasonably powerful, but they weren't really, really needed very much. But then towards the end of that period, a guy called Go Daigo, an emperor, a puppet emperor, decided he didn't want to be a puppet emperor anymore. And he thought, hey, I'll be the real emperor. And he got a bunch of people to take up arms against the Kamakura shogunate. Mm. He almost succeeded. And there was one of the Kamakura generals, a guy called Takuji. He was fighting against Go Daigo originally, but then, you know, like these guys do, when exotericism comes along, it's like stab you in the back at exactly the wrong instant. He switched sides and supported Go Daigo. But, you know, Go Daigo should have known, shouldn't he? You know, somebody like that, you just turn around and stab somebody in the back, they're going to turn around and stab you in the back, which is exactly what he did a couple of years later, yeah. Or even less than that. And he put himself on the throne as the first Ashikaga shogun. This is the second shogunate. So Japan had three great shogunates. There was the Kamakura, the Ashikaga, and the Tokugawa. But then during this period, Takuji and his family, the Ashikaga family, were nowhere near as powerful as the early Kamakura shoguns had been. They couldn't rule Japan. There were a bunch of regional warlords, they called them daimyo, great names, all over Japan, and they couldn't run Japan like that, you know, with an iron fist. They didn't have the military wherewithal to do that, so they had to turn to subterfuge. Well, fortunately from them, there was this bunch of guys known as the Yoshida, who were really good at that kind of thing. So the Yoshida had another boost during this time period and became very, very powerful during the Ashikaga period. And towards the end of the Ashikaga period, in the middle of the Ashikaga period, this guy called Yoshida Kanetomo, who's the most famous person in the whole of Shinto, probably the most famous Shinto practitioner ever. You could call him a shaman, because what he tried to do was get rid of all the exotericism out of Shinto, and he wanted to create what he called Genpon Sogen Yuitsu Shinto, which just basically means Shinto of the original source being shamanism.
Yeah.
And so he brought back this idea that you get in contact with nature through what's already inside you. You know, this was the Amsgar, if you like, was the core of his philosophy. The idea that we start within us and we look at, if you like, the spirit that's within us. The Japanese call that kami. That we gain a communion with that spirit that's within us, the spirit of nature. And through that, we start to extend out into the rest of that spirit, which permeates the entire universe. So, you know, very, very topical guy, because we're here on Amsgar, and Yoshida Kanetomo made Amsgar. It's not called Amsgar in Japanese. It's called Genpon Sogen Yuitsu Shinto, yeah? But which doesn't even trip off the tongue as quickly as Amsgar does, yeah? But the fundamental part of his ideas were to get back to shamanism, if you like, the Shinto of the original source, to get rid of all the Buddhist influence, get rid of all the exotericism. And he did, of course, he didn't fully succeed, but did he ever have a good go at it?
Let's just say, what time period was this again, roughly?
So, well, Kanetomo died in 1511.
Okay, I see.
But he became very, very influential. So effectively, the Ashikaga people were very early. Ashikaga people were very, very powerful. You know, they were great names themselves. They were daimyo themselves. You could say that Takeuchi was the strongest of several regional warlords in Japan. And among those, he was, you know, probably just barely the strongest. But the thing is, if any two of them had ganged up together on him, he'd have been in trouble, yeah? Mm. So hence the subterfuge. And his two successors, Yoshikira and Yoshimitsu. Yoshimitsu is really famous. He's actually the guy after whom the character in the Tekken fighting game is named. But he also the guy who caused the Japanese Taj Mahal, which is called the Temple of the Golden Pavilion. It's supposed to be the most beautiful building in Japan, to be constructed. These guys were the exact opposite of your stereotypical shoguns. So in, you know, Japan historically has been a very, very insular culture up until 1853 when Matthew Perry arrived. It was a very, very insular culture. They didn't like to have too many dealings with the outside world. And what dealings they did have with the outside world, they liked to keep very close control on those. This could possibly be as a result of the Mongol invasions in the sort of 13th century. But just briefly during this period, Yoshikira, and his son, Yoshimitsu, the early Ashikaga period, they opened Japan up to the world. They wanted to start trade with China in a big way. And there was an enormous economic boom, all these massive junks going back and forwards from China to Japan, carrying silks and porcelain and all sorts of weapons, all sorts of things. They had a very, very friendly, unusually, that incredibly friendly relationship with the Japanese, the Chinese Emperor Hong Wu at the time, to the extent that Hong Wu actually recognized Yoshimitsu as the king of Japan. So that basically makes Yoshimitsu, the one and only king that Japan ever had, because obviously Japan's had emperors and Japan's had shoguns, but it only ever had one king. Mm. And he was appointed by Hongwu as the king of Japan. And so there's enormous exchange of trade, and secret societies were running this sort of thing, and those secret those secret societies were all based on these sort of shamanistic secret societies that you get in China, and that got infused into Japanese society. And this idea that you could preserve shamanism inside secret societies, as well as in branches of religion that are more exoteric leaning, was infused into Japanese society at this point in time. So effectively what happened was, anyway, this trade went on, and then it was quite interesting because there was a boom in trade. There was also this enormous, one of the world's biggest ever booms in piracy. And you got the world's biggest ever pirate fleets with, you know, like 300 ships in a pirate fleet. This wasn't like one little ship coming over the horizon, flying the Jolly Roger, like
skull and crossbones.
You know, and I believe they ran an entire province in China, the pirates, for about 100 years, you know. So very, 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 powerful results to this whole thing. And sometimes I've described as, if anyone's familiar with the UK TV series Only Fools and Horses, I've described Yoshi Akira and Yoshimitsu as the sort of Del Boy and Rodney of the shogunate. You know, they got some lamps in the back of the van. Would you like to buy them, kind of thing? But on a much grander scale, they're not your stereotypical idea of shoguns. Obviously, their ancestor Takeuchi had been a more stereotypical shogun, and so the Yoshida became very powerful, and then Kanetomo became very influential. He established a thing called the Daigengu at the Yoshida shrine in Kyoto. Which is, it's a beautiful place. I spent many happy hours there. It's almost magical the way that it's part of a mountain. Mm. And the way that that the whole thing blends into nature, it's obviously what's been trying to be portrayed is that, you know, human beings are not separate from nature. It's very, very shamanistic. But the thing that was unique about the Daigengu was that it had eight sides. It faced off to the eight directions, which is unheard of in a Japanese shrine. Most Japanese shrines are like square, you know, oblong, rectangular. Mm. And this, what he was trying to portray was that, you know, that the kami, the spirits that are inside the shrine are the same as, not different from, the spirit that extends throughout the universe. You get, and in the architecture, the unique architecture that he created, and that Yoshida Shinto created, it sort of tries to use architecture to teach shamanism.
These eight points.
Well, it's the eight directions. It just means in all directions, yeah? Because, you know, by that time, a lot of this idea was, the spirit was inside the shrine. You know, I guess you talk like the Ark of the Covenant. You know, when people were carrying the Ark of the Covenant around, anybody gave them any hassle, they just zapped them with it. You know, that kind of idea, the spirits inside the box sort of thing. He was trying to show, you know, this is just exotericism. This is just you believing stuff. It really isn't like that. And today, in a lot of these things that have descended from the Yoshida and came under the Yoshida, ended up having very broad skirts. I guess you'd say like the Catholic Church had in the West, and everybody just about came, or a lot of people came under their banner, including the organizations that were initiated by a lot of these sort of late 19th century shamans, came under their skirts. And if you go to a typical shrine of one of these things, or a typical Shinto shrine in Japan today, and you look at the actual shrine itself, the little shrine that sits on a big, usually on a big table or something, there's usually a mirror in front of the shrine, a concave mirror. And what that's saying is, although you're sort of clapping, and they do like a double clap in Shinto, and then they bow to the shrine, but what you're actually bowing to is what's reflected in the concave mirror, which is the whole of nature. So you can see the very, very shamanistic ideas being incorporated consciously, because this kind of thing doesn't happen often. Shamans aren't usually interested in that kind of stuff, you know.
Desperately trying to keep these teachings somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but Yoshida Kanetomo, because he operated on such a grand scale, he had to, you know, take into account things like architecture, you know. Mm. And so what happened was the Ashikaga family eventually fell into decline. You can see how far they fell into decline. The 15th Ashikaga shogun, 15th and last guy called Yoshiaki, he wasn't even killed by the warlord who came along to depose him. You know, the guy called Oda Nobunaga who met a sticky end himself in the end. But he just told him to sling his hook, basically. can you imagine for a military leader, you know, it's quite shameful to push off, you know?
Yeah.
So they really weren't very powerful by the end of this period. It was 15 generations after Takeuji set the whole thing up, you know. So obviously they lasted quite a long time. They lasted from, you know, the 1330s through to the 1570s, you know. So it's a long period of time. But obviously with the decline of the Ashikaga, there's a sort of power vacuum there, and the Yoshida became even more powerful. And they became very, very powerful and very influential in Japan right up until the Meiji Restoration, when the period started to decline. So winding all the way back to the original question, why did the shamaness Nakayama Miki frown upon her son Shuji founding this thing called Tenri no Kosho in the 1880s? The answer is that she knew, well, actually it was before the 1880s, she knew that the Yoshida's days were numbered. She knew that the events that were occurring in Japan at that time would inevitably lead to a change in the power structure. Mm. And therefore, there was absolutely no point in going and seeking help from people who weren't going to be around for very long. Yeah. And I believe it was actually a couple of years before the actual Meiji Restoration, that this thing, that Shuji kicked this thing off originally. Mm. And then it developed. So ironically, you know, so Tenri no Kosho then later split into a bunch of different things, a bunch of different religious groups that then started to become exotericized. You know, Nakayama Miki started off as an extremely shamanistic shaman, about as shamanistic as it's possible to get. But then the groups very rapidly split into groups that became very quickly exoteric in nature, super fast. So she died in 1887, and it took only to about 1910 for the biggest group to become heavily exotericized. That's a group called Tenrikyo. But there were many, many other groups that split off. There was another really large group, that split off from a student of hers, a guy called Onishi Aijiro, who was also a very, very shamanistic kind of guy. He was almost like a shaman. Mm. And that was the one called Honmichi, which means like the natural path. Honmichi, the natural path. So again, he's trying to teach people shamanism. But then his group became exotericized really fast. But what's very interesting is, you know, one time we talked about, could Christianity, for instance, have been shamanistic, very shamanistic in its very early days? And, you know, we said that's possible. There's no way of knowing one way or the other. Mm. But if you look at what happened with these shamanistic groups in Japan, it took 20 years maximum for them to become ridiculously exoteric from a very, very shamanistic starting point. This stuff can happen very, very quickly because you've had hundreds and hundreds of years of people being indoctrinated and brainwashed with exotericism. Yeah. And inevitably, they want to know where they sit within these quote-unquote organizations.
Yes.
You know, there are a spectrum, you know. So, if you know, there's probably more than 100 groups that have split off from, for instance, that particular shamaness. She's probably the most famous of them. But like I said, there were many others, Bunjiro Kawate and others. Many, many groups have split off from that. But some of whom are more shamanistic and some of whom are less shamanistic. But it's almost a universal rule that the ones that are less shamanistic are bigger and the ones that are more shamanistic are smaller. Mm. But then in recent years in Japan, we're talking about very, very recent years, pretty much all religions have gone into decline. As the general worldwide trend against religion, away from religion, continues. people have much broader education than they used to have in the old days. And also they view religion, they've been trained to view religion in a very exoteric way. And when you're very well educated and very broadly educated, and you view religion in an exoteric way, it's very, very easy to start pulling holes in it, you know?
Yeah.
That can't possibly be true, you know? It's just nonsense, you know? And so they are going into decline, as is all religion in Japan at the moment. And is that a bad thing? Is that a good thing? Well, you know, from point of view of somebody who's not particularly a fan of exotericism, you say maybe that's a good thing, you know? Mm-hmm. But what's it being replaced with, you know? That's the question. You know, if it's being replaced with something equally exoteric, then it's no better than what went before, you know? So basically the upshot was that there was a long period of development of shamanism into Shinto, and then two later big resurgences of the shamanism. The first one in the sort of late 15th century, early 16th century with Yoshida Kanetomo and his attempt to return to the original Shinto, which is shamanism. And then after the Meiji Restoration, there's a lot of upheaval. And then people, these individual shamans all over Japan gathered followings. So what you can see from this is that shamanism, people start to revert to shamanism when instability is introduced into society, when society starts fragmenting. And that makes perfect sense because shamanism is very, very good at running small groups of people. It's very, yeah, very good mechanism for that. And when society starts to fragment and it doesn't have a great political unity. Remember, I'm not saying unity because, in my opinion, political unity and social unity are two totally different things. But when it doesn't have political unity, people tend to be broken up into smaller groups. And then it's natural that some of those people would find opportunities to revert to shamanism to pick up a following. And so the kind of main place that shamanism exists in Japan today, there are two main places. One is this kind of various types of very, very local out in parts of Japan that are not very urbanized. Very, very local individual shrines that still run that old school kind of a way. Although even in modern Japan, there are various rules and regulations about how you become a Shinto priest and what you've got to study and stuff. So it's still, you know, even modern Japanese society still imposes the miasma on Shinto, you know.
Okay.
But you know, and that was even stronger during the state Shinto period, that effect. And so that's one place. And the famous shrine maidens, the Miko, who are like divinators, they were to start off with. But a lot of them, you know, that they're no more shamanistic than you would say choir boys are in a Christian church, you know. Mm. They've just become part of the ritual, the exoteric ritual that's been absorbed into them from the West and from Western religion and from Buddhism and, you know, from all this kind of stuff. But in some little places, you will find Miku who still practice proper shamanism to a certain extent. And there are thousands and thousands in Japan. To give you an idea of the scale, there are thousands and thousands of shrines in Japan, and probably in less than 100 of them, you may find a real Miku, yeah? Mm. I'll give you an idea of the proportions, yeah? There are also very various branches of Shinto that are more or less shamanistic. We talked about Inari, the goddess Inari, and the type of shamanism that's associated with her. We talked about fox keeping and using foxes as a kind of spirit animal. There's a long tradition of that in Japan that still survives to a greater or less extent in different regions. There are various regional people who act as sort of divinators stroke shamans. There are some people who would literally look at them and say, in Japan, that's a shaman, but you won't find them in the middle of Tokyo, you know? Yeah. But the biggest place where this stuff survives today in Japan is in the various branches of the Shinshukyo, the new religions. But even there, you have to look at it with an educated eye. You have to investigate, and as I've done, you have to investigate and practice that stuff with an educated eye. You will find shedloads of shamanistic technique in those new religions
disguised as other things.
it's not even disguised as other things. It's just dumbed down to the point where it's not as it was. So what I would say is, for instance, some of the exercises, some of the EMSCA exercises, they might involve physical motions, they might involve breathing. Well, EMSCA usually involves breathing in some way, but they will do those motions, but it's just like a dance, you know? Mm. It's not, the original shamanistic content is gone, and it's just become a dance around most of the people. But then even if you take one of these groups, you know, just one of these groups, so let's take, for instance, Bunjiro Kawate's group, Konkokyo. You take one of those groups, there will be a spectrum of people within that group, and within that group there will be some very exoteric people. One of the things we haven't mentioned yet is the strong influence of Western evangelicals on these groups as well, you know. So they wanted, once some of they became power structures, they became organizations, they wanted to spread their teachings, in inverted commas, among more and more people. Well, who were the best people at doing that? You know, so the European and American evangelicals came in and basically taught them how to do that, while simultaneously hoping to convert them over to their way of thinking, and a lot of them did convert over to their way of thinking. And that's another big subject we've skipped, is the esoteric Christianity in Japan. Maybe we'll come back to that at a later date. That's a big subject. Yeah. Because, you know, Christianity has been in Japan for a very long time. But anyway, and had to go underground and become esoteric. But you know, that's a whole podcast in itself. So, but for instance, within Konkokyo, you would have some people who are most of the people, you would say, are very, very exoteric. They believe stuff. They go around believing stuff. But in among them, you'll find a not very vocal bunch who are still practicing esoteric, shamanistic type of technique and practices. Mm-hmm. But they're not conspicuous, because they will annoy their fellow parishioners, if you like, if they're conspicuous about it. So you get this in all of these groups. So, you know, even with it, it's not just comparing one group with another. How shamanistic are they? It's within an individual group. How shamanistic are certain people? You have to, as I've done, you have to seek out those people.
And I presume you've met and seeked out these people.
Well, we better be careful what we say. but not just me. I'd say that you've probably met one of these people. Yeah. But obviously, being interested in esotericism within one of these groups gets frowned upon. Yeah, and you can see that in the fact that, I mean, for instance, this is a bit humorous, you know. You get the founder of one of these groups encouraging the people who are studying with them to practice certain techniques, and then those self-same techniques being banned by the later leadership of that organization. Do you follow what I mean? That is descended from this person who they hold to be their founder. Yeah, it's like, oh, our founder didn't know what they were talking about. You can't don't do that thing that they told you to do.
It's just mad.
It's quite funny, yeah. But they are tremendous. If you approach them in a, and what another issue is translation with these groups. So obviously when they use their translation, they've adopted translation styles of the Western evangelicals. So what you see, you as a Westerner, if you first approach them in a superficial way, what you see is all that stuff. And you've seen it before. You've seen it from, you know, Western evangelicals coming around and knocking on your door and saying these kind of things. You'll see the same kind of stuff in their literature and in their presentations and in the way that they talk to you. But if you dig deeper, you'll find that there is a chasm between what's underneath all that. But you definitely have to dig it up, dig up the root of what's going on there, which is interestingly, unfortunately, what Nakayama Miki encouraged her students to do was dig up the root of what she was teaching, not to take it at face value. And thankfully that was enshrined. And this is why her particular tradition is a particularly good one if you want to understand Japanese shamanism. Well, if you want to understand shamanism, it's a particularly good one. And I would say that for me personally, I've learned so much from the tradition of Nakayama Miki. Just I didn't learn it in the way that if you approach somebody from that transition, they will bill it to you. That's probably the best way to put it.
You read between the lines.
Deeply. Oh, and with assistance, you know, I'm fortunate to have as my teacher, teachers, plural, some great and very, very experienced people. I feel so blessed to have had them. Mm. And without that, you know, no matter how much between the line reading that I was doing. But you've also got to remember, it's not between the lines of a book, it's between the lines of activities, yeah? It's between the lines of what's physically happening and what's happening in terms of people's interactions. And this whole thing with the book, you've always got to remember that, because it's all about books these days, but that came from the West. That came from Western exotericism. Yeah. So again, you know, what do we do as Westerners? You know, we want to know about something. For instance, you know, the tradition of Nakayama Miki, similar tradition on Nishin Ajiro. When there's, we go and buy a book, don't we? And we start reading about it. We want to know about shamanism. We buy a book on shamanism, you know? Yeah. And I think you asked me about that. What are my recommended books, you know? Yeah, no, well, my real recommendation is, that's not how you learn shamanism. Yeah. Don't go and buy a book if you want to learn it. If you want to learn about it, then sure, buy a book. You know, Mercier Liardet's book is probably all you'll ever need to read if you want to learn about shamanism.
Well, another one to mention is, if we particularly for this podcast about Japanese shamanism, is the Catalpa Bow. Surely, that's quite a good
Carmen Blacker. Yeah, Carmen Blacker's book,
not specifically about Japanese shamanism.
Yeah, but. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a good book. It's a good book. I wouldn't say any buts. It's a good book. I love that book. It comes from a very Western point of view. That's all. So that's the caveat I would put on it. possibly less so than Eliade's book does. But you know, thorough research, Carmen Blacker, oh my goodness, you know, there was a thorough researcher, you know. Mm. A great book, yeah. Not much more to say than that. All I would say is that another thing is she tends to focus on these the sort of remnants of what's left in Japan.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I was reading it, and every time she would be like, "Oh, and this is remnants of this technique, but it's gone now." And then I'd read another one. This is a remnant of it. Oh, but it's gone now. Every time.
And as I said, she doesn't, in my opinion, she doesn't focus enough on the Shinshukyo. Maybe she didn't have very good access. I mean, few people do have very good access to, real deep access to the Shinshukyo. And what's behind them. You know, I was fortunate. Sometimes you make your own luck in life, but you know, I was fortunate to run into somebody who's gone deep, you know. Who's gone deep, but maybe, you know, I could have run into 99 out of 100 other members of the same group and got nowhere. So, yeah, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay,
well, I think we're about approaching time. I mean, I did want to talk to you a little bit about your direct experience with Mongolian and Japanese shamanism and the differences that you've experienced or the commonalities you've experienced. But I think we can save that to next time.
Briefly, I can say that there aren't many differences.
Yeah.
I think I've said that before.
Yeah.
And the differences that there are is superficial. Yeah, they're superficial. And the more I understand, the more I become part of shamanism as I go through my life, the more superficial the differences appear to me. A lot of people like to talk about them, but to me, to this point in my life, they've become verging on irrelevances.
Well, I liked what
but I know that they are interesting to people. So maybe we can give a little bit of superficial differences between Mongolian and Japanese shamanism. We'll kick off with that, and then we'll do a Japanese Amsuka exercise.
Yeah. I liked what you were talking about earlier when you were talking about the commonalities, and you mentioned that it's hunter-gatherer shamanism, and there's a difference between hunter-gatherer shamanism and what you might call esoteric shamanism, or the more what shamanism turned into.
The difference is one of purpose, yeah? Mm. Hunter-gatherer shamanism is essential. If you're a hunter-gatherer and you haven't got shamanism, you're not going to live very long.
You're dead.
Yeah, you need it, yeah? If you're a member of a settled, civilized society and you haven't got shamanism, you could survive. Your life will be dull, but you could survive, yeah? So there's a major difference between the two. But esotericism, in the sense that I understand the word, which is the survival of shamanistic practices into civilized society, is shamanism. It's just a form of shamanism. You could call it degenerate if you want. You could call it less essential. But ultimately, deep down, it's exactly the same thing. There's probably a bit less of it, you know, compared to proper full-blown shamanism, but it certainly has value, you know. And I think one of the biggest values it has is just living life and just surviving in life. There's more to life than that, you know. We talked about that that quote about Nietzsche, you know, pictures of cute animals remind make us think that nature's beautiful. It was something like that. And then it went on and said, but out there in real nature, it's all a story of dog eat dog, you know.
Death, disease, and destruction.
Destruction, that was it, yeah. And I said, well, if that's the case, why are hunter-gatherers always smiling? You know? And why aren't people in civilized societies always smiling? We do have big problems with depression in our society that they don't have. We have a lot of problems with mental health, lots of different mental health issues that they don't have. We certainly have a poor level of physical fitness compared to what they have. And you could say that we do have some great things that they don't have. We have a very, very sophisticated medicine. Mm. And we have, you know, we have computers and all this kind of stuff. So fair enough, you know, but why do you have to choose between the two? That's the esoteric question. Why not just have both, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is what this podcast is all about. It's trying to reconnect us with that lost part, isn't it? That lost part of ourselves. Right, well, if there's nothing else you want to go into now, then I think we better wrap this up, so...
Okay, mate.
Yeah, cool?
Yeah, cool.
Okay, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Dermon, and we'll continue this on the next episode with Japanese shamanism and maybe go into the... fourth, is it? Amsuka technique? Might be the fourth Amsuka technique next episode. Fantastic. Check out the website, guys, www.wovenenergy.com. There you can grab yourself a Get Started episode, which is exclusive to the email list, so get yourself signed up. Till next time, thanks so much. Keep practicing, and we'll see you soon.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.